From The Day in New London, Connecticut, I'm Taylor Hartz.
And I'm Sten Spinella.
And this is Looking for the Tote Family. More than a year into our investigation, there are still so many things we don't know about what happened to the Tote family. We have some answers, but we don't have the answers everybody, including us, wants. We don't know who did it, and we can't conclusively answer the big question of why. But we do have a better understanding of the details. We have a sense of how the murders affected Colchester, Connecticut, and Celebration, Florida. And we're able to put together the story of this family's life. We've spoken to so many people who knew them and loved them and mourned them. And with everything we've learned, we can hold some of Tony's claims up to the light. It's tempting to accept the idea that Tony is a guilty monster, that this was an evil act he committed. It can seem black and white, cut and dry. 2 days after his arrest, police say Tony confessed, and that's that. But we haven't seen Tony's alleged confession, and he hasn't been convicted yet. In fact, he's pleaded not guilty. Unfortunately, we can't ask anyone else what happened on Reserve Place that night. And until last week, we hadn't been able to talk to Tony. But then, right before we were about to publish this episode, I got an unexpected phone call. Tony Tote called me from jail, and I finally got a chance to speak to the only person who was inside that house and was still alive to talk about it. We're going to let you hear that phone call, but first, we want to walk you through everything we know so far.
While reporting on this case, our chief concern has always been presenting the facts. Those facts have been spread out over 9 episodes, so we thought it would be a good idea to distill this story down to a timeline of the month leading up to the murders and the weeks following. On November 21st of 2019, the FBI went to Tony's physical therapy offices in Colchester. Federal agents spoke with Tony during a search of the premises. He admitted to illegal practices related to the healthcare fraud and took full responsibility. He agreed to retain an attorney soon after November 21st and told federal agents he'd return to Connecticut from Florida on December 8th. He didn't return. Chrissy said Tony left Connecticut on the next day, November 22nd, to fly to Florida for Thanksgiving. Family members told us it was unusual that Tony, Megan, and the kids weren't back in Connecticut for Thanksgiving 6 days later on the 28th. They also didn't go to Connecticut to see their families for Christmas. On December 1st, the family didn't pay their rent. Later that month, they received a summons for eviction and were sued by their landlord. On December 14th, Alec and Tyler performed at a music recital in Celebration. Their music teacher, Bobby Sedwick, said that Megan, Tony, and Zoe were in the audience watching the recital. She said it stood out to her that no one in the family, including the boys, dressed up in holiday attire like the rest of the performers and their families. Photos of Alec and Tyler at this recital, each holding a certificate of achievement they received there, were published in the Hartford Courant, provided by Sedwick. Those certificates can be seen inside one of the Tote's vehicles in crime scene photos. This was the last time that we know of that anyone saw the Tote family alive. The week before Christmas, Tony told Megan's aunt Cindy not to worry if she doesn't hear from the family, as they'll be going on vacation and won't be reachable. Crime scene photos show a December 18th receipt of Tony's from when he went to Academy Sports and Outdoors, a sporting goods store about 15 minutes from his home in Celebration, and bought a Strike Point FPS pellet gun and a packet of airgun ammunition. In photos of Tony right after his arrest, he has small, round wounds on his body. An article in The Sun speculated that the gun could have caused those wounds, but we have no evidence that there could be a connection. The last few days before Christmas, somewhere between December 21st and the 24th, Cindy said she got a text from Megan's phone saying that the kids were sick but leaving for vacation in St. Augustine soon. Chrissy called Osceola County Police on December 29th.
I'm wondering if somebody can do a wellness check on my brother.
She says she'd been told the kids had the flu for a couple weeks recently and they were really down and out during Christmas. Police visited the home that night but didn't make contact. They didn't attempt to check on the family for 10 days after that.
On New Year's Day 2020, Megan and Tony would have celebrated their 20th wedding anniversary. But from what we know, Megan was already dead by that date, and Tony was living in the house with her body. That week, their family took to social media for clues about their whereabouts, desperate to find them and their children. Tony texted his sister for the last time on January 6th, but one of Tony's relatives received one last text from his phone, from a stranger who had found it at a Starbucks in Sarasota, Florida, 2 hours away from the Totes' house. After that, it was radio silence. Back in Connecticut, an eviction notice was served at one of Tony's physical therapy practices. He hadn't paid the rent, adding another $6,000 to the family's growing debt. A few days later, an FBI agent from Connecticut contacted the sheriff's office in Osceola County.
Maybe if I could just talk to someone regarding a person that they did welfare check on.
The next day, Chrissy called police again.
He has stopped all communications. And we have not spoken to Megan. Nobody has heard from Megan.
Police went back to the Totes' house and condo that evening. No one answered, so they left. They went back to the house the next day, January 11th, to perform another check. No one answered, so again, they left. On January 12th, the sheriff's office got another call for a wellness check.
I own the property that I rent out, and I have concerns for the family.
It wasn't clear whether police responded to that call. On January 13th, a federal agent was staked out in front of the Totes' house.
I saw the guy get out of the house and sit on his front porch.
Federal agents and deputies from the sheriff's office arrived at the house to arrest Tony for healthcare fraud.
We decided it's time to go in and get him.
They could smell decomposition and saw Tony standing at the top of the stairs, unsteady on his feet.
We asked him where Megan and the children were. He said, Megan was upstairs sleeping, and he also, called for her.
Investigators went upstairs and looked into the master bedroom.
And you could see feet.
So they went into the bedroom and unwrapped bundles of blankets, where they found the bodies. Tony was taken into custody and brought to a hospital for an attempted suicide. Sometime between January 13th and 14th, Tony allegedly confessed to the murders while he was at the hospital. Agents said that Tony was awake, alert, and of sound mind when he confessed, and that the family's injuries were consistent with his confession.
The most detailed information we have about what happened at 202 Reserve Place between November 22nd and January 13th comes from Tony's letters and phone calls from jail. We wanted to see how his timeline matched up with the timeline we put together from our reporting. We should note that there's much we can't verify in what Tony says.
In his letter to his father, Tony says he was supposed to meet up with a lawyer in Connecticut on Wednesday, December 4th, and then return to Florida for a doctor's appointment for Megan the next day. But he says he woke up Sunday, December 1st, to find Megan burning her journals and canceled his trip to Connecticut out of concern for her. He makes Megan out to be increasingly erratic, canceling her appointment and refusing medication. He says that Megan had turned more and more spiritual over the last few years for guidance due to her illness. He also says that he was not fleeing to Florida, that authorities knew he was going there, and that he kept in touch with them via phone up until his attempted suicide.
Tony doesn't provide a date for the killings and what he wrote to his father, but he describes memory loss after them. He says he doesn't remember Christmas or the weeks following. Based on his narrative, the murders took place between December 14th, 2019, the day of Alec and Tyler's recital, and Christmas. Tony says the day of the killings was pleasant. After dinner, he says he left the rental home and went to the family's condo to fix some things and get Zoe's Mickey Mouse necklace. We found multiple inconsistencies here. He tells Chrissy in a February phone call that he went to get the necklace because it was the last thing we needed, and that he fell asleep with the intention of waking up by 11 or 11:30 p.m. In that phone call, it sounds like he knew something was going to happen, and he needed to be back at the house by a specific time that evening. In the letter, written in June, he specifically mentions 11:30 p.m. as the time that Megan killed the children while he was out of the house. He tells his father he planned to sleep at the condo because he had trouble sleeping in their bedroom. Megan's natural oil and air fresheners gave him sinus problems and made him snore. He says his plan was to return early the next morning to perform physical therapy on Megan, just like any other day. He then describes coming home to find a Benadryl-laced pie Megan used to drug the children before killing them. He says Megan had a vision of the end of the world that prompted her to kill the kids.
My sister-in-law was making a comment about...
Chrissy verified Megan's beliefs in a January phone call to police in Florida.
Basically, the world ending on the 28th and nobody has talked to them.
In the letter, Tony details a peaceful scene where he tends to the bodies of his deceased children. He tells his father there is no sign of struggle, but doesn't mention the zip ties and nylon strap shown in the crime scene photos. In all 27 pages of that letter, he makes no mention of Breezy. Perhaps the most glaring inconsistency is Tony's claim that Megan committed suicide by stabbing herself twice in front of him. The autopsy showed two stab wounds in Megan's abdomen, but the medical examiner ruled her death a homicide.
In his letter to his father, Tony says that after his family died, he was so grief-stricken that he attempted to kill himself 8 times. He also said he went out to buy cheese, Benadryl, and Galumpkies around the same time that his phone was found in Sarasota. He says that the night before he was arrested, he took so much Benadryl in an attempt to kill himself that it caused significant memory loss. He says he doesn't remember conversations with relatives during that period, including an argument with his sister, Chrissy. He also says he doesn't remember going to the hospital or to jail, but then goes on to give specific details about his arrest and his time in the hospital. Because police and prosecutors allege that Tony is the killer, and that he confessed, we tend to look at Tony's version of events with deep skepticism. That's what we're trained to do as journalists. But we also apply that same skepticism to law enforcement. And until Tony goes to trial, we don't know what evidence the prosecution has against him. We always want to hear both sides of every story, but unfortunately, we can't hear Megan's side of this one. The best we can get is Megan's aunt and uncle, Cindy and Stuart, her closest relatives. I asked them what they thought about Tony's letter and his claims about their niece, that she was nearly bedridden with illness, was running a years-long fraud scheme, and that she killed her children and herself. Her uncle sent me this statement.
Tony has already confessed to the crimes, the healthcare fraud in Connecticut and the murders in Florida. The story he's telling his father, and apparently himself, is just that, a story, a fiction that allows him to live in a dream world and avoid the actual world where innocent lives were taken and the lives of family and friends were shattered. A fiction to avoid the real world filled with horrors, horrors he created and has admitted to. Tony's portrayal of Megan as an invalid is simply false. When I saw her last in 2019, she was the same Megan I always remember. Bright and cheerful, full of energy, and with a full schedule activities for the kids. A middle-aged mom doting over 3 beautiful children, having the time of her life. Cindy and I soldier on without Megan, Alex, Tyler, and Zoe, and little Breezy, and await the trial in Osceola County with the hope that sufficient evidence is brought to dispel all doubt as to what happened in Celebration, Florida. We miss them dearly, and we think of them every day with love.
We spoke to a lot of people who said that to them, Megan never seemed sick, let alone bedridden. Kirsten Bettman, Megan's childhood friend, stayed in touch with Megan via social media and never saw her depicted as anything other than the vibrant person she remembered from their childhood in Montville.
From the outside world, watching her life edited by her, right? We all can present a version of ourselves online however we see fit. And most or many people present the best parts of themselves, highlight the good sides of their life. And very rarely do I see a lot of vulnerability. And that would be the case for Megan. I remember all these years being like, oh my God, she has all of her shit together, right? She's beautiful. She has these three kids that she's managing. She has her job. She's baking all the time. She's completely active and involved with every aspect of her children's lives while still maintaining a seemingly healthy social life. She loves her husband. Everything is perfect. It almost made me feel a little bit sad about the imperfect aspects of my own life by seeing this very obviously edited version of who she was. But I don't question that she was doing all of those things. I know that she was.
Even Robert Tote, who said he believes his son's claims of innocence, couldn't make sense of this image of Megan as a murderer.
To me, she was a beautiful lady. I mean, someone you could be proud of and someone that you would look at any point in your life and say, you know, there's nothing bad I can say. I don't know.
Scott Ward, a Celebration resident, says that people were angered by these accusations against Megan.
You know, you're changing a lot of things, right? So when you guys came down here, it was still shock, a lot of people not understanding. You know, how do we explain this to our kids? All of that kind of stuff, dealing with it, right? The interesting part that people talk about now, because the news is starting to cover it here locally a little bit more in depth, is what he's doing to try to spin this, right? People were in shock before. Now there's a lot of just deep anger, a lot of compounded shock to think that he would come out with this trying to blame it on her.
Scott said since we visited him in Celebration about a year ago, town residents have shied away from discussing the Tote family.
People, I have found, don't even want to talk about it, right? They're just disgusted, and it's one of those taboo subjects now.
Linda Akerman described a similar mood in Colchester.
There's no evidence of his businesses anymore, and it's not talked about. And it is almost a taboo subject. It almost feels like nobody wants to mention it. Nobody wants to talk about it.
She said the town, for the most part, is trying to move on.
I don't want to say it's been forgotten. Those of us that knew Tony or knew the family or knew the children, I think we are forever changed. I know for myself, as I drive through town and I still look over at his buildings, on a daily drive, I pass one or both of his practices. They are on opposite ends of town. One has turned into a new physical therapy place, and I'm really not sure what the other one is, but both signs have been taken down. There's no evidence of his practice anymore in town.
Sue Reed, who lived nearby the Totes, has lived in Celebration for more than two decades. She led an effort in the wake of the murders for the neighborhood to reconnect. But she said COVID-19 has essentially destroyed that effort.
It's been very, very difficult to maintain that because of COVID. You know, that threw a total monkey wrench into everything.
She and others are still moved to sadness often when thinking about the murders.
There was something there, a memorial for them for quite some time. I can't remember how long, but it was very noticeable to me when it was gone. And I just thought, sad, you know, that we don't have something permanent. Because when I walk by it, I do think about them. I never even knew them, but I just think, you know, I just sort of say, I'm so sorry that horror happened to you.
Christina Garrity, whose son was friends with the Tote Boys, told us that this tragedy still affects her family almost every day.
We were all sort of in shock for a while. I think that the mourning process didn't even really begin until like the fall of this year and holidays, when we were still going through the firsts, like the first year without them for Thanksgiving, the first year without them for Christmas.
Her son Liam just started playing basketball again a few weeks ago. For more than a year, he hadn't wanted to go near the basketball hoop behind their house, Alec and Tyler's hoop.
It was strange because the very last time we saw them was Thanksgiving Day when we were throwing the ball in the alley. My son was dreading that day this past year because he hadn't been out. We'd gotten the basketball hoop, but he hadn't been out to play basketball since we had it. He just wouldn't play. I'm still going to get a plaque made. And what's nice is my son just went back out to start playing like last week, literally. And if I get that plaque up there, it's a healing process for him too. I think more kids are going to come.
Liam also cherishes Alec and Tyler's baseball cards. And his mom said he is glad that he has those to remember them by. She bought them at an estate sale that was held at the Totes house, where the things that once belonged to Megan, Alec, Tyler, Zoe, Breezy, and even Tony were all for sale. She said that going into the house for the estate sale was a harrowing experience, but she's glad she did it.
Oh, my heart was in my throat. What was really strange is seeing the front room where my son would be playing board games with them, seeing baby items, seeing doggy items that were for sale. Oddly, they were selling things like his shoes, like big flip-flops and stuff. And I was like, why are you selling his things? I don't know. It was a very strange experience. My heart was in my throat. And it felt a little creepy to have people walking through. You know, it just felt irreverent. You know, and the only reason I went in and put my big girl pants on was because I needed to get some things of Zoe's for that family, because I was devastated for them. They couldn't even get one of her items. And that's the only reason I went in there. My son went in and he got Alec and Tyler's baseball cards because they used to trade, and he got a whole box of their cards. So that was something that was like a little bit of healing when he goes up and he has theirs and it says Alec and Tyler on the box.
She went because she wanted to get some things that belonged to Zoe to send to family members here in Connecticut.
So I was in touch with his sisters. I met them. I met the aunt and uncle, and they all came down here to gather the belongings. But as it turned out, they were never able to get anything of Zoe's. So I got some things from the estate sale of Zoe's. And I was able to get these items from the home, from the estate sale. I got her cowboy boots. I got mini ears with her name on it. I got a cowgirl hat and a little bikini. Just these precious little items. And I was able to mail them to the family on the day that they decided put the family truly to rest, like have their service, and it got there just in time. So it was perfect.
Christina told us that what happened to the totes isn't something she and her neighbors have forgotten about.
We all talk about it pretty regularly because everybody's awaiting a trial. And people are really concerned he's creating a shadow of doubt that might be believable to somebody in a jury. And I think it angers them.
Christina also answered a question we'd been wanting to know the answer to. Does anyone live in that house?
And the lady who owned the house originally, she moved in. She and her husband and her son moved in. They rented the garage apartment, but they live there now. It was like a condemned home, spiritually and emotionally. And, you know, they couldn't rent it or sell it to save their lives. So they live in it now.
Here in Connecticut, some of Tony's former patients were still grappling with the tragedy. Dawn Barden, who we heard from in episode 1, said that despite everything, she's still grateful that she met Tony. She said that almost every day, she uses a skill Tony taught her to help care for her daughter.
I learned so much with him, and thankfully I was able to take a lot of that with me as far as like help her until, you know, if it's a weekend, I can do a little bit of adjusting and help her to be able to walk still or move still a little bit better than nothing, you know. And I'm still thankful that we had Tony.
She said that Tony was always a helpful, attentive physical therapist, and that the two often talked about their families. She didn't know Megan personally, but she did say that Tony often talked about how sick his wife was, and how much he had to help her.
Sometimes he said that she had bad days where she couldn't do anything. And that's why he would miss an appointment. You know, he had to fly out early or something. Megan and Courtney have similar problems. He was like, yeah, the bones just get like really stiff, like, you know, where she can't. I said, she can't move. She's like, it seems like my daughter gets frozen sometimes. So he was like, yeah, you know, Megan's like that sometimes. And this is what we have to do, make sure that she's always warm and everything else.
Dawn said she's been going back and forth about whether she wants to write Tony a letter, thanking him for everything. She said she started writing one and stopped several times.
I part of me wants to write to him and just thank him, but part of me is just like, I'm afraid that everybody's going to like pick it apart and the news and just, you know, just so much stuff. It wouldn't be anything bad. It would just be thanking him, but I just don't want to be put in the center of, hey, why are you communicating?
She's still on the fence, but thinks that at the end of the day, she wants him to know how much he helped her daughter.
I'll take that with me forever, you know, and I'm forever grateful that he showed me a lot, you know, and that we had him as a therapist. And unfortunately, the tragedy that happened, but, you know, I can't go backwards, but I can take everything I learned and take it with me.
We've struggled with how exactly to report on the theories out there about this case, many of which were posited before we even started work on the podcast. We're uneasy about it because we don't know some of the answers and don't want to propagate false narratives. But the theories we chose to address are ubiquitous. We see them everywhere, we're asked about them constantly, so we thought it better to bring them up than to pretend they don't exist. There are about four overlapping theories that connect the dots, which the trial will hopefully connect, between the family's financial, legal, and other troubles, and the deaths of Megan, the children, and Breezy. One popular theory is that Tony knew he was going to jail and didn't want his kids to go through the same thing he did as a child. Tony has repeatedly discussed the difficulties of having a father who spent extended time in prison. But that could mean he doesn't want to repeat his father's mistakes, not that he wants to follow in his footsteps. Another theory goes that Megan found out about the fraud and legal issues and threatened to take the kids and leave Tony. So Tony decided, if I can't have them, nobody can. Proof of the family's financial issues are well documented, but that extra step of, they caused Tony to kill his family, is hard to take without more evidence. This theory assumes that Megan knows about both the alleged fraud and the federal investigation into it. It's the theory that lends itself best to the prosecution's case, as police have positioned Tony to be the murderer. It's the most popular theory from the sources we've spoken to, as their best guess was Tony just snapped. Or maybe Megan and Tony were both complicit. They did this together, both believing in some kind of world-ending prophecy. They both planned to commit suicide, but in the end, Tony didn't go through with it. Tony did say he tried to commit suicide, but the motivation was his grief over the death of his family. Then there is Tony's story, which is that Megan, believing in some kind of end-of-the-world prophecy, kills the kids and herself. Tony says he was guilty that he wasn't there, and admits in some ways that he acted irrationally, but he says Megan is behind the healthcare fraud and the killings, among other allegations he makes about her. It's difficult to outright refute Tony's tale given Chrissy's phone call mentioning Megan's talk about the world ending on the 28th. But Tony changes his story based on who he's talking to. His alibi for not being at the rental home when his family was killed, his shifting timeline of events, and his conveniently spotty memory, among other inconsistencies, mean I would be surprised if Tony's black and white version of Megan did everything was true. When you hear a story like this and you're only given bits and pieces of information, of course the tendency is to try to fill in the blanks. That's what these theories do. They're stories that people try to tell to make sense of something that you can't make sense of. Some of the facts we've been able to find do line up with some versions of these stories. But in the end, without talking to someone who was actually there, we're unable to answer a lot of these unanswered questions.
When Sten and I went to Florida, we went to the Osceola County Jail and asked if we could speak to Tony. We were told that the chances of talking to him were slim to none.
Do you want to, read it to me?
Yeah.
And I'll write it down. Yeah.
But a few weeks ago, we decided it was worth a shot, and we wrote him a letter.
All right, you ready?
Yes.
Dear Mr. Tote, this is Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella.
At the end of the letter, we gave him our cell phone numbers and asked him to call us if he'd be willing to talk.
To tell your side of the story, call us at either 860-7...
Less than a week after I placed that letter in the mail, I got a phone call I wasn't expecting. It was almost 9 o'clock on a Monday night when I looked down at my phone to see that I'd missed a call from Florida. I had a voicemail from the Osceola County Department of Corrections.
To refuse this call, hang up now. To block this call and all future calls, press or say 9.
I tried to call back and was told that they couldn't connect me with an inmate. I'd just have to wait for them to call again. I didn't have to wait long. A few seconds later, my phone started to ring. An incoming call from Kissimmee, Florida.
Hello, you have a call at no expense to you from...
Tony who?
An inmate at
Osceola County Corrections Department.
To accept this call, press or say 5.
And then, for the first time, I spoke to Tony Tote.
Good evening. This is Taylor Hart there, please.
Yes, hi, this is Taylor.
Hi, Taylor, this is Tony Tote. How are you?
Hi, Tony, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm here.
Tony didn't tell us anything groundbreaking in this call, but just hearing from him was a shock. I never expected to speak with him before his trial, if ever. I definitely didn't expect to speak with him that night, so I might sound a little nervous.
I got your letter today.
Okay, I'm glad you got it.
I appreciate your integrity. I appreciate the fact that there is actually a wannabe journalist out there who actually wants the facts of the case.
Absolutely.
I appreciate that. And being from, you know, a small town, being in Mountville and Colchester, I appreciate the small town flair.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, though, I'm going to try this case in the court of law,
okay.
And not in the media.
Okay.
No disrespect to you. That's why
no,
I'm calling
I understand.
You. I appreciate you reaching it out, as I've been advised by other attorneys.
Sure.
But I am going to tell you, I have a newfound respect to at least yourself in
the
media.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm being honest with you. Honest guy and that kind of stuff.
He told me he wasn't willing to discuss the details of his case, but that as soon as his trial was over, he'd sit down and tell me everything.
And I'm telling you, when this is over, because it is going to trial in September,
mm-hmm.
Lie down here, I will be first one to meet with you after I'm done.
Okay, thank you.
I wish I could sit down and tell you everything and tell you exactly what happened, exactly everything, all the intricacies about this case, but right now, like I said, I'm going to try this in a court of law, not in a court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how it goes with a court of public opinion, you know what I mean? So, unfortunately, we have to wait a little bit, you know, before I can really talk to you like as such, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And like I said, being from your small town newspaper, I don't know how it all works because I'm one to shy away from the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
I do everything behind the scenes. I'm sure, I don't know what you've talked to, who you've talked to, but I'm not a guy for glory. I'm not a guy for whatever. I'm a guy whose word is in bond and that kind of stuff. And if you come down here, I'll make sure that you have the sufficient amount of time you need to know everything there is, all your questions answered, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything that you would like to share that anyone you think that we should talk to make sure that your story is and your family story is told accurately?
You know, the only one that can actually tell my story is myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do that, like I said, when you come down.
Okay.
Or after the thing, I will sit with you,
okay.
Like I said, and you know, whatever questions you have, I have nothing to hide.
I tried to ask Tony about other things I wanted to know from him that didn't involve the details of the murders. What he knew about his upcoming trial, how he expects it to play out, and how he was doing in prison.
I'm a very strong person. So, and I have the support of my sister and my family, so.
Are you aware of when the trial is going to begin? Have you found out any information about that?
September 20. Oh golly. I want to say it's the 25th or the 27th. Mm-hmm. You guys published it on page 2 of your paper.
I wanted to ask him outright whether he killed his family, but I didn't, because he'd made it clear that he didn't want to talk about the details of his case. But I did ask him how he'd be pleading when his case goes to trial.
The plea has already been put in as innocent.
Okay, then you'll be maintaining that?
The truth is the truth.
I understand. We've been investigating the Tote family for over a year now, and Tony is the only member of that family who is alive, and now, potentially, willing to speak with us. I asked Tony if he'd be willing to have another conversation with me, and he said he would.
Feel free to keep in touch. I won't be able to tell you much about the case or anything detail whatsoever.
Sure.
I appreciate you having the respect of my family and my sister especially.
Absolutely.
She's really blunted the load of most of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, like I said, you know, it's nice to know there's some integrity out there in the news media.
For now, I'm open to discussing anything that Tony is willing to talk about. After the trial, we hope to take him up on his offer to sit down and hear everything he has to say.
If my attorneys allow me to say anything, I'll tell you.
Okay.
But other than that, I can't, you know?
That's okay. I understand. I look forward to the day that you can. Despite his alleged confession, Tony entered a plea of not guilty on all charges. His trial is set to start on September 27th, with pretrial proceedings starting the week before. Last year, State's Attorney Aramis Ayala convened a grand jury to vote on whether Florida should pursue the death penalty against Tony. Unlike in most states, Florida requires a person to be indicted by a grand jury in order to face first-degree murder charges. The state also seeks the opinions of an independent death penalty review board before deciding if they'll pursue the death penalty. In this case, a grand jury voted to indict Tony, and the review board voted that Tony should face death. In January, just before Ayala left office, she announced that the state would no longer seek the death penalty against Tony because of mental health concerns. It's unclear whether the new state's attorney can, or will, go back on that decision.
It's easy to live in the national headlines about the Tote family murders, to view them with the same sort of forbidden intrigue as the Daily Mail or People magazine. Taylor and I are guilty of it. We're enthralled by the strange storytelling possibilities of the idiosyncratic town of Celebration. We are not immune to the allure of the occult and its infinite or infinitesimal role in the narrative. It's possible that the mystical, apocalyptic beliefs Tony talks about Megan having are the driving force in all of this. Or it's possible that it's a coincidence Tony weaponized. Breezy's death boggles our minds too, and adds a depth of disgust to our already vast reservoir. The larger story told itself before it was told. Assault of the Earth family with seemingly solid financial means is exposed and unraveled with brutal acts of violence. Staying in this space makes it easier for us to digest what happened in Celebration, Florida. It means we can think about these crimes against humanity in a detached, third-person sort of way. We can speculate on theories, consider the media's coverage, and treat it like a cautionary folktale. For people in Celebration, Colchester, and Montville, among other places, this is not a folktale, nor is it a media spectacle. Depending on the person, it's cherished relatives taken too soon. It's a chilling family legacy that unfortunately came full circle. It's the loss of connection with neighbors. It's the loss of the imagined innocence of two towns. It's money troubles, deception, confusion, tragedy, loss. It's the most unspeakable and unthinkable things that could happen to people we care about. The trial may bolster some theories. It may tie up some loose ends. Maybe, somehow, all of our questions will be answered. None of that matters, really. Four people and a dog are still dead. No answer is answer enough.
While this is the last episode for now, we're not going to stop reporting on this story. There are still people we want to talk to, and leads that we want to pursue.
We plan to cover Tony's trial and to sit down for that interview Tony promised us. Whenever we have something new to share, we'll post an episode in this podcast feed. You probably have questions about this case, so we're planning an upcoming Q&A episode. To submit your questions, send us a voice memo or an email at topepodcast@theday.com. If you or someone you know is in crisis, help is available. Call Mental Health America's crisis hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. And Izaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.